From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As we do before every major sporting event, the Only a Game staff sat down earlier this summer to decide how to cover this year's Tour de France. For the past few years, the interviews we had planned with cycling experts about which rider had the edge on the hill climbs and who was likely to dominate in the sprints had degenerated into endless conversations about blood transfusions, testosterone levels, and failed doping controls. We decided that we'd had enough. We would give this year's Tour de France as little attention as possible. We've taken a lot of heat from listeners for that stance, but now that the tour is over, we feel it deserves a wrap-up. Joining me now on the line is Bonnie DeSimone, who covered this year's Tour de Scandal for ESPN.com. Bonnie, welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me.
At least three riders, all big names, tested positive during this tour. Two teams went home, and Michael Rasmussen, the holder of the yellow jersey, was kicked out. As the tour wrapped up, one seasoned cycling writer said, this year's tour could be defined in only one way, an utter fiasco. Would you agree?
Bill, I disagree with that completely. I really am in the perhaps minority of folks that feel that what we're watching is a sport that is maybe not in a perfect way, but trying to clean itself up. And the price for clean sport is heavy. You're going to have stars knocked out. You're going to have competitions that have big holes blown through them. But at least cycling is trying to address the problem.
Despite everything that happened during this tour, more Americans watched the tour on Versus than ever before. More than 20 million people tuned in for some or all of the 23-day race, up from 18 million in 2006. Did those viewers see a race that was worth watching?
Well, you make an interesting point, Bill. I wondered aloud in one of my columns whether perhaps doping bus had become the equivalent of NASCAR crashes and people are sort of waiting to see who gets kicked out next. I think the tour is always going to be a great telegenic event. It's a beautiful event. If you just take away all of the controversy, then I do think this was a really wide-open tour that was going to make a new star, probably. I'm a little surprised by the numbers. I'm surprised in this country at the numbers, but I think it just goes to show that there was a base created during the Lance Armstrong years that is not going to go away soon.
And competition is competition. When you get a great finish, some people would say that's what you need to get a great race.
This was a bizarre one, though. I mean, to have the race, essentially the standings, decapitated 4 days before the end of the race, there was almost a huge reshuffling, but in the end, things stayed the same, and Contador won. Cadel Evans from Australia finished second, and Levi Leipheimer was third.
Tour de France organizers have thus far only attempted to excise the names of two winners, Bjarne Riis in 1996 and Floyd Landis last year, but many of the men who joined Riis and Landis on the podium have also been implicated in various doping scandals. How did tour organizers decide who got an asterisk and who didn't?
Well, Bill, you're hitting on a pet peeve of mine. The answer is that their decisions are being made piecemeal, and I think in a rather irrational way. My feeling is that you can't just scrub people out of the record books. If you want to add material saying Bjarne Riis won in 1996, 10 years later or 11 years later, confessed to having doped during his career, add that to the history book. Don't erase it from the history book, because you're just going to wind up with, as you point out, a lot of contradictions, a lot of basically hypocrisy.
Cycling fans have been writing to me saying that if baseball or football were to test as often as cycling tests, just as many cheaters would be caught. I suppose one way to interpret the number of positive tests in this tour would be to see it as a sign that the doping controls are working better than they used to. Cheaters are being caught and punished. How much of the surge in doping positives comes from the fact that testers are now looking harder for the cheaters and using better tools in their search?
There's no question that that's a factor. there's a woman, she is now in charge of anti-doping policy, essentially. Her name is Ann Gripper. And one of the things she said this spring is, hey, we're not just going to do random tests anymore. We are going to target test riders that we believe are exhibiting suspicious activity. So there's no question I think that's going to make a difference in the scores, so to speak. And on your other point, who knows? I mean, it's all a matter of speculation to say that there's as much doping going on in football or baseball or any other sport. What I do believe is that what the Tour de France brought to the forefront is that all of us, and that's journalists and fans and people in the industry and athletes, we all have to decide what we prefer, because when we try to have clean sport, as we saw in the Tour just now, it's very messy. For example, the Rasmussen controversy and the way he was forced out of the race when he was in the lead 5 days before the end, you would have to compare that to a baseball pitcher for a World Series team thrown out before his Game 7 start.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're serious about wanting clean sport, you have to accept the possibility that that might happen.
Before this year's race even began, there was bad blood between UCI, the sport's international governing body, and the organizers of the tour. If these two organizations split, that can't be good for the sport.
No, you've hit really what I would consider to be almost as grave a threat to the sport as doping itself. The dysfunctionality of the bureaucracies and the organizations that run the sport. I mean, honestly, during the tour, what appeared to be happening was that the UCI and the ASO, which is the parent company that owns the tour, were using doping as a bludgeon to hit each other over the head rather than presenting a united front and saying this is a scourge and we want to get rid of it. And it's really a typical sad story of ego and turf wars. And if it doesn't get solved, I honestly believe that that would be something that would turn sponsors off more than doping itself, because if you've got people trying to knife each other in the back, then the long-term future of your sport is not rosy.
Bonnie DeSimone covered the Tour de France for ESPN.com. Bonnie, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
Each summer, some of the best young golfers in the U.S. travel around the country to play in tournaments run by the American Junior Golf Association. At one such tournament, at the Tedesco Country Club in Marblehead, Massachusetts last month, Monday, the practice day, was marred by rain for everyone except 17-year-old Sarah Jackson, who has a history of performing well in bad weather.
Yeah, I am a mutter. I really am. That's what my dad calls me.
Sarah's dad plays to a 10 handicap, meaning he shoots in the low 80s. I asked Sarah, whose handicap is 4, when she had first beaten him.
Oh, my God. Probably like 3 years ago.
So you were how old?
I was 14. Probably 13 to 14.
Maybe it was raining that day, too, at least for Dad. Her early success hasn't convinced Sarah Jackson that she wants to play golf for a living. In fact, she thinks she might want to be a high school math teacher, which perhaps explains why she's still living in the Northeast, unlike some of those against whom she was competing.
We are from New Jersey, but about a year and a half, we moved down to Florida in Orlando. Lake Mary, actually. Lake Mary, which is outside of Orlando.
Lena Pock is the mother of 16-year-old Isabel Hahn, on whose behalf the family relocated.
It wasn't easy. We thought about it and rethought about it. But and then she's the one who wanted it. She said, okay, I'm very serious now with golf. She wanted to play all year round. And she said, eventually, she wants to become a professional golfer.
Isabel, who celebrated her 16th birthday last Wednesday, is in no hurry to turn pro. She wants to go to college, though she won't knock her peers who've tried competing on the LPGA Tour as teenagers.
I mean, that's great for those players. They're very talented, but, I mean, anything can happen. You know, you can get hurt, you know, by accidents. So, I mean, education is just always there. Just in case you don't, you know, as long as you don't hurt your brain, then you're set.
So higher education is in the picture for Isabel, but that picture is still a little fuzzy.
Well, actually, UCLA sent me a letter and a questionnaire. They sent it to me my sophomore year, so they couldn't formally recruit me until next year when I turned junior. I want to go to Duke because they have a great golf team, And I guess Duke and UCLA. Those are my one and two.
Not going to stay in Florida?
Well, I want to stay close to Florida because my teacher's there. I don't want to go all the way to California. Well, it is in California. Oops. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Find another teacher.
Or maybe we'll just fly back. Whatever happens, God knows.
Isabel Hahn can laugh about whatever might happen next, especially as she has already attracted the attention of at least one golf coach. But for the coaches, there's no giggling at a tournament like the one in Marblehead.
This is a worthwhile trip. I came here for a specific purpose. I had a chance to see what I came to see. I'm going to see it again tomorrow.
That's Sue Nias, the women's golf coach at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. And though she was willing to tell me she'd come to Marblehead to see one particular golfer, Nias wouldn't tell me who that golfer was.
Because if I do, then I violate the NCAA rules.
Seated under an umbrella at the first tee, Sue Nias watched the juniors hit their drives and then trudge into the drizzle and mist. Coach Nias wears a BYU jacket to the tournaments and a BYU visor, so though she cannot talk to the players, they cannot fail to know the BYU coach is watching. The NCAA also forbids Nias from calling potential players, although they are allowed to call her. All the rules are set up to protect the student-athletes from the vicious coaches, Nias says. Assuming that this would be a frustrating circumstance, and given that the coach had already acknowledged that she comes to these tournaments dressed, in her words, like a placard, I suggested that maybe she should wear her phone number on the back of her BYU jacket, the way caddies at the Masters wear on their backs the names of the golfers whose bags they're carrying.
That's a good idea. I carry my cards, but no, I'll do that. I'm going to start putting my phone number up. That's a great idea. I like that.
So if the Brigham Young women's golf team suddenly gets great, you'll know where the triumph began. Sue Nias says she can spot talent in a golfer who's half a dozen years shy of becoming a freshman.
Well, they could be very young. If they've got some potential, it's pretty apparent, even if they're, 12 or 13 years old. You see athletic ability. You see a person who's got balance and who can swing the golf club.
Can you tell anything about competitive nature at that age?
You can. And the other thing that's really important is you see how they treat their parents. If they're treating their parents well, then likely you'll be treated well. And if they don't treat their parents very well, or they're yelling at their dad who's on the bag, or they're having family fights about the golf, then you know that maybe that's not where you want to go. So there's a lot to be gleaned from watching them playing these little events.
Of course, these events are not so little for the players. They haven't all relocated to find better teachers and a climate more hospitable to year-round golf. But according to Evan Harmeling, who'll attend Princeton in the fall and play golf there, a lot of the young men playing in Marblehead see themselves as future touring pros.
I'd say more than you'd think. I'd say maybe close to, in a tournament like this of 80 kids or whatever, 80 guys, maybe 30 or 40, at least want to. And I think maybe 10 or 15 think they have, actually believe that they have a chance. So that's a pretty high number.
Harmeling faced more pressure than some of the other competitors. His family lives in Reading, Massachusetts, just down the interstate from Marblehead, though he tried not to let that affect his approach to the tournament.
I'd be happy with anything in the top, probably 5 or 10. I mean, obviously I want to win it, and I'm not going to be completely happy if I don't, but I'm not going to be mad as I go out there and shoot 85, 86, something like that. I won't get too worked up about it.
In fact, Evan Harmeling shot an exceptionally efficient 68 during the final round of the Tedesco Country Club event, but that was not good enough to lift him into the top 10. Isabel Hahn improved each day of the tournament, turning in rounds of 80, 77, and 74. She finished second. The top juniors will next gather on Monday in Village of Pinehurst, North Carolina, for the Golf Pride Junior Classic, except for the ones who will be at the tournament at the Rivercut Golf Course in Springfield, Missouri, or the Smithfield Junior Championship in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Gee, for these kids, returning to school is going to feel like a vacation. Here now to discuss the week's sports news is the gentleman we refer to as the real sports guy, Charlie Pierce. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Boston Celtics got better this week, eh?
Well, they managed to put together a really tremendous marketing program for the 2007-2008 season. They will sell a lot of tickets. They will be spoken about on the radio. They will make the back page of the local tabloid and the front page of the local broadsheet sports sections. They also have, absent Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, and Paul Pierce, the worst roster in the NBA by a factor of about 10. So they will be relevant. They will draw a lot of interest. They will be fun to watch. They will win more games. But people are getting awfully giddy over a team that has utterly no bench at this point.
Well, this giddiness is perhaps the point. Commissioner Stern is certainly hoping that trading Kevin Garnett will distract people from last week's big NBA story. Any chance that that will happen?
Well, it did for a while, but that, unfortunately, the thing with legal cases is they go on and on and on and on. The Tim Donaghy scandal got bigger. A gambler named Peter Ruggieri, who talked to the FBI, said he noticed things were a little fishy, making him the world's smartest gambler. And the operator of a sports bar outside of Philly is apparently going to be indicted in connection with the same thing. So this thing just keeps metastasizing at the heart of the game.
Some cite the signings of Garnett, Zach Randolph, and Rashard Lewis to the Celtics, Knicks, and Magic, respectively, as proof that the NBA's Eastern Conference is finally catching up with the West. You go along with that?
Well, they've become more interesting. It's a more offensively-minded conference now. The Celtics are going to outscore people because they, frankly, put together a really bad defensive team. If the big guy in Miami decides he wants a last hurrah and gets in shape, that's a very good offensive team. Certainly the Wizards and even the Knicks have the potential to be that, as do the Bulls. So, yes, I think that the running Western Conference has a little bit of a challenge now from the guys in the East, everybody except Detroit.
On Monday, Bill Walsh died. He was 75 years old, and among his achievements was turning a bad San Francisco 49ers team into a Super Bowl winner over the course of just 3 years. A lot of people know about that. Fewer know that he once successfully impersonated a bellboy.
Apparently, at the first Super Bowl, which took place in Pontiac, Michigan, the first Super Bowl that his 49ers went to, apparently he put a bellman's uniform on and started collecting people's bags at the curb and briefly got into a little bit of a tussle with Joe Montana, who when Walsh tried to take his briefcase. Now, my question, beyond the fact that who knew Bill Walsh as baggy pants comedian, is what did Joe Montana possibly have in a briefcase?
I can't get out of my head the image of Vince Lombardi doing this. It just wouldn't have happened.
Well, as we know from David Marinus's book, Vince used to dress up in priest's robes and mime the performance of the mask.
Yes.
But at least he did that in private.
Were you surprised to learn that, yes, the cable network that shows New York Yankees games is now for sale?
I was, actually, and it's an indication, I think, more than anything else, that George Steinbrenner is failing, as has been rumored. You know, to split the YES Network away from the Yankees is something I don't think he would have done, but I think people are positioning themselves, particularly his heirs apparent, for the post-George Steinbrenner era in New York.
The Dodgers held a steroids awareness clinic on Thursday night before their game against, wait for it, the Giants. I'm sure this was completely coincidental.
That's what the Dodger spokesman said. It was a complete coincidence. Who knew Barry was coming? They only made the schedule out a year ago.
The Chicago Cubs slipped into first place on Wednesday, Charlie, and their manager, Lou Piniella, cautioned against excessive optimism. I wonder if that was really necessary.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the idea of Lou Piniella cautioning anyone for being overly emotional about anything is pretty hilarious. Of course, they went in there at the expense of the plucky Milwaukee Brewers, who fell into second place, and manager Ned Yost and a couple of his players started tangling, which, by the way, is exactly when the Cubs turned their season around, when two of their players got in a fight. So maybe that's the way to do it.
Last week, we marveled at the scandals rocking the sports world, and now we may have another one, this one involving tennis. What's this all about?
Yes, an ATP tournament in Poland. Now, you would wonder, you know, why there would be anybody would care about this, but we are living in the globalized, internet-connected age.
Simple answer, money.
And a British online gambling company killed all the bets. A match between Nikolai Davidenko, who was number 4 ranked, and the number 87 ranked Martin Vassallo Arguello of Argentina. All of a sudden, Betfair got $7 million in bets on the match, which is 10 times the usual amount, and they kept coming in even after Davidenko won the first set.
And they were
now,
betting on the other guy.
I'm not Damon Runyon, okay? But if the money still comes on the guy when he's behind, I'm staying away from the favorite.
Former Dallas Maverick Roy Tarpley scored a legal victory this week when the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission ruled that the NBA violated the Americans with Disabilities Act when it banned him from the league back in 1995 for violating the league's substance abuse policy. Do you think this will set a precedent and undermine efforts of sports governing bodies to crack down on substance abuse?
Well, it's interesting. It may submarine their policies against recreational drugs. Roy Tarpley's problem, of course, was with cocaine. And we've all, you know, the steroid hysteria has been such that it's drowned out all this other stuff. But under the law, drug addiction is a disability. And you cannot discriminate somebody based on a disability. So this does put the recreational pharmaceutical piece of anti-drug programs in professional sports under a very interesting microscope now.
Yeah, and, you know, regardless of what happens in the future, does everybody else who's ever been banned from any league now suddenly have a case?
Well, presumably if they've been clean since then. Yeah, because obviously if they've continued to use drugs and they keep testing positive, the clock starts again. But by all accounts, Tarpley has been clean since he was banned. And the EEOC, under an administration which is not a big fan of the EEOC, is behind him.
Iraq's national soccer team captured the Asian Cup Sunday in Jakarta. This really does rank as one of the best upsets in recent times.
Absent all the incredible extraneous factors going on around the Iraqi team, this was an amazing upset by a team. The Saudis are far and away the best soccer team in that area. I know because when I was there in Qatar years ago for the Asian Zone qualifying, they were far and away better than Japan. They were better than South Korea. And for the Iraqis to come together and beat these guys is just an astonishing feat of athletic achievement, if nothing else. And I have to admit, I got to love any team that's called the Lions of the Two Rivers.
History is in the making at St. Andrews this week, Charlie, as the Women's British Open is ongoing there. Shall we raise a pint to celebrate the occasion?
First time women's professional golf has played the old course. This is one of the last barriers left, the one unassailable parapet, of course, being the one in Augusta, Georgia.
And finally, Charlie, we have another world record to celebrate.
We've got one a week now.
Would you please do the honors?
A Tasmanian fellow beat the world static cycling record. In other words, he took 111 hours, 11 minutes, 11 seconds to go absolutely nowhere. And apparently has taken the record and thrown it way far ahead of a lot of other people who are pursuing the record without going anywhere at all.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.